Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm joined by Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Nick.
And by Matt Welch, the editor-at-large of Reason. Matt, thanks for coming on board.
Hello to you both.
So let's start talking about something that's particularly important and in the news, by which I mean, of course, the emergence of The Rock, the former professional wrestler turned movie star who is suddenly all over magazine covers. He's got a new movie coming out, a remake of Baywatch, of all things. But he has emerged as a kind of darling of the media. He's a good guy and of Republicans and conservatives in particular. Catherine, you have been studying The Rock with the female gaze, I'm guessing anyway. What do you make of The Rock as a kind of culture figure who is getting a lot of attention for his kind of centrist conservative politics, it seems?
This is the logical conclusion of just increasingly empty vessels with which we pour in our hopes and dreams. The Rock, we don't know what his politics are. He like one time said something about maybe liking America and apple pie and motherhood. So probably he's a conservative. That's good enough. The fact that National Review and GQ have both obligingly done PR for his new movie suggests that American politics is even more dysfunctional than we previously believed. It's now just an arm of like Hollywood advertising.
So, and the fact, I mean, do the conservatives know that he actually played in the Canadian Football League? He was on the University of Miami. He won a national title back in the 80s when the Bad Boys of U of M were astride the college scene. But he was a Canadian football player before he's a second generation or might even be a third generation professional wrestler, too, where he was a heel and then a hero. Matt, do you have strong feelings about The Rock?
Only in the sense that if he runs on a ticket with Greg Popovich, the great San Antonio Spurs coach, who yesterday, I believe, went off on an extended anguished tirade against Donald Trump. So if you were able to get that ticket going, and either way, you could either call it Rock Pop or Pop Rock. And I think that's the ticket going forward. It's clear that the Donald Trump example makes sure that we're going to have more celebrities either floating trial balloons or actually getting into the game and outsiders. And I think that's going to be a permanent, semi-permanent feature of American politics going forward. A guy I follow on Twitter named Eric Sturrock, I believe, who's great libertarian, has been dredging up old audio interviews of The Rock showing that he's a secret libertarian on drugs and on some other things, and says that he's basically a fiscal conservative, but he's socially liberal. So, you know, a new round of people getting excited about that. But I'm mostly with Catherine, in which I just want the madness to stop and I can get into my opioid coma.
The laugh test is not a thing anymore, right? I mean, because we all thought, oh, well, Donald Trump doesn't pass the laugh test, so we don't have to worry about it. And the one lesson we seem to have taken is, oh, great, now we have to take everyone's candidacy, no matter how far in advance, no matter how little grounded, totally seriously. And maybe a few years from now, I will be eating my words as we inaugurate President Dwayne Johnson, Dwayne Douglas Johnson.
He is, you know, I'm a big fan of, he's got a show on HBO, which I think will be starting up soon again, a new season, Ballers, where he plays a former player who has injuries and whatnot and becomes a financial manager for fellow players. And it's actually a really good show. And I have to say that, you know, Catherine, I think when you were talking about like projecting onto him, he's a really good guy. Like in the show, he is, you know, he's troubled, but he's moral and he's principled. Matt, he is kind of, you know, he's socially liberal and fiscally conservative and Ballers. I don't know.
And he's jacked. Let's be honest. I mean, I saw those Baywatch posters all over the place flying to and from New York and L.A. And I was looking at that. I mean, the guy is he's got to be somewhere around my age at this point, and he's looking pretty good. Look a little bit better than I am, frankly.
We don't need false modesty on the Reason Podcast, Matt. Nobody is more cut or ripped or tatted up than you.
And we can say this with all the confidence of people that are producing audio content right now.
Yes, absolutely. So, well, who are there any other besides Greg Popovich who is, you know, he might be too polemical for a fantasy player, you know, for a fantasy candidate. But are there other politicians or celebrities, and are there female celebrities who would also play a similar role? Because most of the, you know, when you think of the gadflies who actually got into office, as, you know, somebody like Michael Bloomberg as mayor of New York and whatnot, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, they tend to be men, don't they? Are there female celebrities that might actually have a shot or play a similar function that The Rock seems to be doing for conservatives or liberals?
Oprah Winfrey, ladies and gentlemen, just Oprah.
Oh, yeah.
That's all you need.
Yeah,
I would throw in for Courtney Love. I mean, if we're just going to do it, let's do it. Let's do it. Let's bring the crazy. You know, crazy always beats strong in a fight, Nick, as you well know. So yeah, let's just bring
so
the crazy.
We could literally have crazy versus strong, and it would be Love versus Rock, which also sounds
My God, the Rock
amazing.
Of Love. I have to say, too, I am actually interested in Courtney Love's take on the opioid crisis and how we can make that bigger. Because I don't see her, she doesn't have a good track record of you know, coming to terms with that. But well, as long as you know, we're talking about Trump and what Trump has opened up and made possible in America, including a potential onslaught of celebrities running for office, you know, Ben Affleck perhaps. Matt, what is going on among you've talked a bit about how conservatives are now they're in a phase and certainly before Trump was elected, the National Review people and a couple of other conservatives came out as anti-Trump. Now they seem to be functioning more as anti-Trump, so that they are not really defending Trump per se, but they are attacking people who attack Trump for what they consider kind of baseless ideological reasons. What's going on with that? And is that, you know, I hate to say it, but Catherine, I think you kind of clued into something when you were like, this is just one more sign that we are just, you know, this is after the fall. You know, we are not getting back into the Garden of Eden and it's just shit all the way down. But Matt, what is, what's going on with the anti-Trumpism?
I saw a thing yesterday. I think it was on Fox and Friends. Certainly a Fox program. They tweeted out a clip of a guy saying, I was a Kasich voter last time around, but I've moved to defend Trump because I'm so sick of the media. And I thought that was a nice encapsulation. I don't know how widespread that feeling actually is, but you can certainly see kind of demonstrations of that within the conservative media, where there's just a story after story bemoaning the fact that someone got excited that Donald Trump is getting two scoops of ice cream instead of one, and that just shows that we live in a dumb age, and so therefore, etc. I think that two things can be true at once, and people are having a hard time holding it in their heads, which is that Donald Trump could be behaving in an erratic and unfortunate and authoritarian-ish manner that requires some prophylactic defense among our institutions, and at the same time, the media can be hysterical about it. And the way I would look at this is how many people in the fall of 2001 and all through 2002 and 2003 spent a lot of their political energy essentially punching hippies, talking about how International Answer was in the middle of anti-war rallies, and so therefore anti-war rallies or the anti-war sentiment itself is wrong, or talking about you know, the long Afghan winter in like scare quotes, laughing and mocking people who predicted that the U.S. would get bogged down in a quagmire in Afghanistan, which we totally have done in an occupational sense. At some point, if you lose sight of who is actually wielding power. And yes, the media does have power, a lot of it. But who has the guns? And at this point, Donald Trump has the guns. And I find myself feeling a little bit empty watching people go into a kind of 95% anti-media bias stance, even though I totally get where they're coming from. And on many senses, they're right. It's just that there's always going to be hysteria around you. Is that going to distract you away from who is wielding power in such a way that you failed to oppose bad activity in real time? I'm cognizant of that and have been since Trump was elected.
I we're still talking about The Rock, right?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, Catherine, what do you make of that? And as somebody who I'm not making any news here, but as somebody who worked at the Weekly Standard, an anti-Trump conservative magazine, how are your former colleagues holding up with Trump? Are they pleasantly surprised by what he's doing? Are they more appalled than they ever thought they would be? And are they just attacking the media rather than going after Trump himself?
1 second before I slipped into blissful unconsciousness on Friday night, I got a little ping on my phone. It was Bill Kristol retweeting me about how we have two problems. One problem that the president thinks he invented the phrase prime the pump. Second problem, the president thinks he can prime the pump.
By the way, we all know I invented priming the pump in 1987. Trump is totally riding off of what I did. But
yeah, take the credit, Nick. Do it.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think at the very least we can say that Bill Kristol is not thrilled with the Trump presidency so far, though I, of course, cannot speak for him and his many Straussian layers in his commentary. I will say, though, just on what Matt was saying earlier, I think if there's anything that we've learned, it's that hate, like love, doesn't need to be divided. It can only be multiplied. We can hate Trump and the media. We can do that. I know that we have enough hate in our hearts. I certainly do. But of course, he's right that we should prioritize our hate. Probably Arya Stark, like we should make a list over and over and repeat it to ourselves in the night. And the guys with the guns should be at the top.
I guess redirected slightly from hate. This talk of love and hate is too nuanced for me, but there's a great old song by Public Image Limited Pill called Rise, and one of the lines is anger is an energy. And it seems to me that that Trump channeled anger pretty well, that the Democrats are trying to channel anger. Bernie Sanders channeled anger pretty well. But I wonder if, where does this leave us in terms of anything really happening, whether it's with guns or without, Matt? I mean, and from a libertarian perspective, it seems that sometimes we're constantly we're constantly talking about how it's good when the government doesn't get anything done. The flip side of that is that the government doesn't have to, they don't have to do anything in order for spending to go up and for a lot of things that are already in play to keep kind of moving under their own volition. Where should libertarians be thinking about intervening into this cycle of of being for or against aspects of Trump, being anti-Trump or being anti-anti-Trump? Where do you find your little place that you like to hang out?
I mean, the you work backwards through what can the government do to you. I always see kind of journalism and commentary ultimately as an act of self-defense. And even as Republicans probably are not going to get a lot done legislatively, although I was surprised that the House went ahead and passed the American Healthcare Act. I don't think it's going anywhere in the Senate, but who knows? It's possible. But ultimately, I think pretty soon, sooner rather than later, the Trump legislative agenda is going to get bogged down and not kind of going anywhere. But the place where presidents have a lot of power is in law enforcement and the waging of war and that kind of executive branch enforcement things, which is why in real time I was chagrined at the way that both Democrats and Republicans who know better didn't prioritize opposing Jeff Sessions as the number one thing instead of getting, sidetracked into Betsy DeVos madness all over the place. Because Jeff Sessions on Friday very, very predictably repealed or rolled back the drug war to 2013, which is, we don't have any kind of care about the abuses of mandatory minimum sentencing and these types of things. He's got these 1981 ideas about the drug war, and he's going to enforce them because he can. He has this latitude. So I think from my perspective, I want to apply pressure to people to start fixing the underlying legislation. I mean, we had criminal justice reform had a lot of momentum as of early 2016, but with the rise of Trump and you know, talking a lot about Blue Lives Matter and you know, being a law and order presidency, people like Ted Cruz flipped noticeably on the issue. What the, Sessions' action should remobilize people who want to reform the mandatory minimum sentencing regime, which is one of the most odious, but not by any means the only artifact of the evils of the drug war. And the people who are not going to prioritize this on in either party should be made to suffer, because the president sadly has this great amount of discretion and enforcement latitude. And when you get an attorney general like this, and also, I mean, I'm very keen on making sure that whoever is appointed as FBI director is someone who is not coming directly from the political process, particularly in a zone of the political process that has been apologetic to Trump's power. So I would like to see a lot more oversight done by Congress, particularly among people who have called themselves over the past 6 years constitutional conservatives.
Catherine, do you think The Rock would be a good FBI director?
I mean, it would at least give us a chance to check out his prowess in political the political arena, since we already know about his prowess in all other types of arenas.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think Matt is totally right about the Jeff Sessions point in particular. Jeff Sessions now seems to be the only person in Washington who knows what he wants and also knows how to get it. And that's a terrifying world. I don't want to live in that world.
Well, what do you do then? So, you know, here we are. If only we knew some people in the media or if we had contact with elected officials at the highest level of government, what do we do to exert pressure against somebody like Jeff Sessions, who is kind of, it's a clean sweep. He, as a senator, he was pretty good on spending issues, actually, but that was it. He's terrible on immigration. He's not good on trade. He's awful on the drug war. He's awful on all sorts of lifestyle issues. You know, what is the best way to kind of try and quarantine Jeff Sessions' impact, you know, on if not the Justice Department, then things like state-level legalization of marijuana?
I think it's tricky because there's so much hysteria, right? Like the baseline hysteria level is so high that to add our voices, to add the voice of reason even to the hysteria and say, the thing we should be hysterical about is Jeff Sessions is very tricky because it's hard to be heard over the din of the sort of wailing of the sinners. And, I wonder if one answer here is, you know, is just to think about how to change the institutional constraints that, the power of Congress to actually vet appointees. I think we saw, particularly in Rand Paul's vote and others, that Congress has lost faith in its own role in that process. This is sort of unhelpful meta commentary on top of the fact that Jeff Sessions is right now throwing every person who has ever even thought about smoking weed in jail.
I would add to that, Nick, I think we will see, and we're starting to already, I think, did Vermont, the legislator, just passed a legal marijuana, and I'm sorry if I'm getting some of the details of that wrong, but we're...
And by the way, what was particularly interesting about that is it was the first time that a legislature did recreational marijuana. So in the past, it had been done essentially either medical marijuana or it was done through a ballot initiative process for recreational pot. So this is, a very, this is a real sign that what happened in November in California and a couple of other places is not going away.
Yeah, and I think that's an avenue, particularly though hopefully not only in Democratic controlled states and legislatures, in a similar way that, a lot of Democratic states deep under the Bush the George W. Bush presidency started passing a lot of nonsense, frankly, like California's stem cell initiative and all this kind of stuff, but as a direct reaction to Washington. So I would love it if they decided to react against Jeff Sessions by passing state level defections from the federal regime. You already see some of this in terms of blue city and blue state resistance to some of the immigration initiatives about sanctuary cities and whatnot. That would be healthy, but I think it's also important to apply pressure on those senators, particularly ones who know better or at least have some suspicions about Sessions and also other kind of bad areas of Trumpism, stuff like free trade and elsewhere, to kind of insist that they put their money where their mouths are and where appropriate, reject toadies. I mean, one of the problems with Jeff Sessions is not just all the things that you mentioned, Nick, but also that he was absolutely key politically to Trump. He's arguably the most important member of the Senate to get behind him early and often. And there's a whole kind of subsection of ideology that he represents. The kind of Steve Bannon approach is very Jeff Sessionsite. And so he's going to be allied to Trump more politically than ever. So it's very important that whoever gets appointed to FBI director or in any kind of key position is not a person who has such loyalty, like Chris Christie or Rudy Giuliani, both of whom were terrible on their own reasons, but they have reasons on top of that to be particularly loyal to Trump. Just can't have that in the law enforcement apparatus, I don't think, at this time. We have to play some defense out there.
And I do want to say one of the darkest moments that I had during the presidential primary debates was this moment when the field was starting to winnow down a little bit. And I was suddenly struck with this idea, oh, my God, Chris Christie is going to be the AG. Like there was this like moment when the configuration looked like that was a thing that could happen. And that seemed like a worst case scenario. But as usual, events have proved me wrong. There is a worse or worst case scenario. And it is the Sessions-Christie dynamic duo of law enforcement heads that really boggles the mind. But I agree. Theoretically, this is a position where politics could counterbalance other politics. But when you have someone who is, if we are to believe the rumors as published in the New York Times, calling in his FBI directors to say, will you be loyal to me? We're sort of past a point of institutional and kind of traditional barriers between the presidency and the FBI working effectively.
But aren't we also missing a larger point here with, you know, because this was the amount of love that people, particularly liberal Democrats who were calling for James Comey's head during the election, are now aghast that he would be replaced. There's this odd thing. I mean, the attorney general's role is to be the president's bagman and hitman. And maybe in a better world, that wouldn't be the case. But at least, you know, I mean, just to keep it shorter than it has to be, at least going back to Janet Reno, who was a terrible attorney general who violated all sorts of protocols of decency and human sanity in her quest to rid cable TV, over which she had absolutely no jurisdiction, of what she considered fictional violence or fantasy violence back in the 90s, in between, you know, burning Branch Davidians to death and things like that. I mean, the attorney general is a terrible person, a terrible position, and they're always a political hack. What's weird is that Sessions actually was, by most accounts, the brain trust behind Trump's obsession with immigration, as well as a lot of the free trade type stuff. But with the FBI director, who of course is also reports to the attorney general, as well as the president, you know, what are we expecting? You know, Louis Freeh was an awful FBI director. J. Edgar Hoover, you know, was terrible. I mean, this is an agency that has a very clear record of either doing stupid things like spending time collecting material on John Lennon, or spending like 18 months and a couple of $1 million trying to figure out the lyrics to Louie Louie, which is actually something the FBI tried to do and fail in the mid-60s. And then, you know, they're at the center of virtually every violation
service.
of yeah, you know, we get by, you know, you just mumble it. But it's, you know, I mean, what should we be looking for in an FBI director that is realistic? Or is it really, this is the moment where the wheels are coming off a lot of 20th century political institutions, including something like, you know, the FBI, which, you know, is a 20th century phenomenon. You know, or is it just ridiculous to expect an independent FBI director? In any case, and like, was Comey any good before he got bounced? That's, you know, I keep waiting to hear all of the, oh, you know, he was so great. Like, he didn't spy on Americans. He didn't do this. He didn't, you know, it's like, you know, where is any of that information?
I have no way to judge, unlike apparently 80% of the country, depending on what's, you know, what point of the electoral calendar it is. I don't have any independent way to judge whether James Comey was any good. I presume, based on things similar to your windup there, Nick, that he was kind of generally awful, as FBI directors tend to be. But we do know one thing about James Comey, is that he was willing to kind of independently and even in a grandstanding-y, showboaty way, as necessary, defy the wishes of powerful politicians. That is a useful trait, regardless of any negative traits, in that position, particularly now with this president. So I don't think that having a president prematurely terminate an FBI director and doing so based on pretty rank motivation, which he himself admits to after getting his surrogates to lie about, I don't think that's a way to solve J. Edgar Hoover or what the FBI did to Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, John Lennon did need a little bit of investigation. The power to the people. Come on, enough. This is not the moment to think that this is the avenue towards reform. It isn't. Regardless of the monster that is going to be the next FBI director who will do monstrous things because he will hold power. All I want is someone who isn't Jeff Sessions. I want, you know, if it's Merrick Garland, great, even though that's a total troll of a trial balloon. But I just want someone who is independent outside of the political process, who's not John Cornyn or some god-awful thing like that. And, you know, if he comes from the institutions of the FBI, great. But have it be someone who's independent, because this president has displayed a worrying trend in the world.
Well, can we is this a place where, you know, we've actually talked a bit about Congress and its abdication, you know, which is you know, clear in the war making function of Congress. You know, they've been AWOL for decades. But is this the place where we can actually expect or demand that Congress step up and do something? Because, say, for instance, you know, the Russia investigation, or the investigation of how or to what extent Russia hacked and had an impact on the election, you know, that's interesting and it's important. And it's clear that's not going away because of, you know, Comey being fired. And the real gutsy investigation is probably going to come from Congress anyway, rather than law enforcement. So are we in a pretty good situation there?
I don't know. I would be happier to have the appointment of a special counsel within the FBI apparatus of the investigation here, which is just a slightly kind of prophylactic, a level of independence there for the investigation, either a special counsel or a select committee of Congress to do this, because just I want another layer of independence there. I don't have confidence, based on the reporting out there, and some of the reporting I'm sure is alarmist, and some of the people who are being quoted anonymously from the FBI are probably being alarmist too. But you have heard people from within the FBI saying that this will impact, or they worry that it will impact the investigation. And I say this somewhat, and Nick, I think that you agree with me, and a lot of the reason world agrees with me. I don't necessarily think there's anything underneath all of this. I think likely as not, what we will discover is that once investigated, Donald Trump acted like a cornered rat and behaved in ways that was borderline obstructing justice, even though he's obstructing it probably just to make a bad – or, you know, likely to make bad publicity go away rather than trying to cover up that he was openly colluding with Vladimir Putin to throw an election. Even though that is true, it still points to bad behavior on the part of a president, and that's worth investigating regardless of whether it's going to fulfill this secret democratic desire to have the election results called into so much question that we can declare Hillary Clinton the winner. She lost, and it's a point that that people need to make. Constantly, I think there's this desire to say that somehow of all the meddling that happens constantly in elections, including the U.S. meddling and other people's elections, suddenly somehow this was the one that flipped the result from where it should have been. This is such fantasy and wish fulfillment, and you know we saw it in the.
So why don't we focus on that? I mean, in the sense of even calls for a special prosecutor. I remember the '90s, which was kind of like the high water mark of special prosecutors because of Ken Starr. And the fact that the Clintons had both been in favor at various points of updating the special or renewing special prosecutor laws that were coming out of originally out of Watergate. And then, there were a couple of cycles after that. I don't think there's any reason to believe that special prosecutors do anything other than kind of bleed whoever they're investigating for as long as possible and waste a lot of money. And it's like, fuck Congress. I mean, like, if this is such a big deal, then, they can investigate all of this stuff. And we already know Trump is a troll and a jerk and, is I don't even know that he's a liar, because I really do think he's like George Costanza on Seinfeld, where it's, it's not really a lie if you believe it. Like, I think his consciousness is just a bunch of barely connected utterances that he utterly believes as factually true and dogmatically true whenever he says them. And it's just when you look at any three in a row, you realize that he's not making a lot of sense. But I don't know. It's like
I think it's important to split the hair here of the difference between a 90s style independent counsel like Ken Starr was and what a special prosecutor was. The independent counsel law expired in 1999, and I don't think it's coming back anytime soon for the reason that you state. It's just kind of a blank check, and you can spend $40, $80 million just kind of investigating every last thread that occurs to you. A special prosecutor is just a little bit of extra protection within an existing FBI investigation. It's not a blank check to do everything. It just means that you're protected a little bit from above. It's not that big of a deal. And so I think that's worth that little extra layer. And I would like to see a select committee, independent committee of Congress investigate. And Justin Amash and Walter Jones, so far as I know, are the two only Republicans who have signed on to a Democrat bill in the House of Representatives to talk about that. I would like to see that happen, but I think that there's reason to suspect, given the behavior, particularly of people like Jason Chaffetz and others, that Republicans are not showing a lot of interest in taking this president the same level of scrutiny, or anything remotely like the same level of scrutiny, that they were willing to engage both with Barack Obama and then that they had planned to engage with Hillary Clinton once she was supposed to win. I don't have a lot of faith in and respect for Congress's sense of oversight here. And some of the comments of people like Rand Paul, which just makes what I think is a pretty juvenile thing of like, oh, you hated Comey yesterday, now you totally love him. Yeah, I mean, that's true and it's funny, but it actually doesn't get to the root of what the issue is in front of us, which is that Donald Trump fired somebody motivated in part to make an investigation that touches him and touches his operation go away. That's troubling. And you've got to be troubled by that, I think, on some level, regardless of how much Democrats are a bunch of hypocrites and are in hysterics.
Catherine, do you hope that we'll be able to, that we're just a couple of investigations away from finding out what happened at Benghazi?
Yeah, any minute now, the Permanent Select Committee on Benghazi is going to put out their report. No, I mean, I think that actually does raise the question of, well, what is the best case scenario? Say there is a truly independent investigation. Say that they have all the resources they need. You know, 4 years from now, we're going to have a 900-page report, half of which will be classified, that will say, well, something bad maybe happened, but it's now so far in the past as to be unchangeable, essentially. I guess I just wonder what even could be the best case scenario for a truly independent investigation. Not to say that we shouldn't have the capacity to do that. We should. But in this particular case, it's not clear to me what we could possibly find.
For me, the best case scenario is just the executive branch gets harassed by the legislative branch. I'm good with that. I'm totally fine with that just as a general principle. I mean, I think that the Obama administration there should have been a special special counsel, and even maybe a select committee, based on the Clinton emails and the Loretta Lynch meeting with Bill Clinton. You know, all these have more investigations. I'm totally in favor of it because the executive branch has too much damn power, and they should be asked to explain themselves more fully. And even if it turns up that there isn't a magic, you know, leprechaun full of Richard Nixon. That makes a lot of sense, Catherine. Don't even start with me.
Jesus.
At the end.
H. Christ.
Jesus is correct. Then it's still worth it. It's a way to put a little sand in the gears of Washington. And I think that on its own is a worthwhile endeavor.
Wow. That's nihilistic, which I kind of like, Matt. I see living
it's
on the East Coast.
It's not nihilistic enough.
Really
I disagree. I think like it's insufficiently nihilistic because it somehow still posits that somewhere at the end of all of this harassment of the executive branch, we wind up with a constrained government, that we wind up with an executive or even more broadly, just anyone anywhere in power who says like, oh, gee, maybe I shouldn't do something awful because someone might find out. Like, first of all, if that's our best case scenario, bad news, but that's still not nihilism. Nihilism would just be to say, like, just, you know, throw it all into the swamp and let's just upload our brains and get the hell out of here.
That's not nihilism either, actually. I take it back. That's a different approach,
but not nihilism.
I just can't get worked up. I can't even get worked up about nihilism today.
Oh,
so
man, it's that
know.
Kind of day, yeah. Huh? Somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
You go to battle with the stupid constitution that you have or with whatever tools you're lying around, and you hope for marginal improvements. And otherwise, again, you get back to the opioids.
So, Matt, last week I was talking with the Federalist and CNN's Mary Catherine Hamm, and she used the same metaphor to argue for the Rock's candidacy, saying you go into an election with the electorate you have. And if that means that we're our best case scenario here is like Rock versus Mark Zuckerberg, then there you have it. That's not a good metaphor. We can do something to change the quality of the electorate we have, right?
Let's send them all
subscriptions to Reason Magazine.
Yeah, that would all we need is the exemption from first class mail for nonprofit magazines, I guess, if people still do that, or we'll do it electronically, or we'll post it for free at reason.com. You can get early and full access by paying $15. But you know, I'm kind of happy, and this touches on something too. There have been a bunch of scare stories recently about how the black vote was down substantially in 2016, and it's always with the whisper that there's some kind of voter suppression going on. But overall voters, the overall percentage of eligible voters that came out in 2016 was lower than in 2012. And I think that's a sign of sanity in the electorate, actually, that they're like, you know, when they were shown the two absolute shittiest menu items in a TGI Fridays, they were like, okay, thanks. We're going to stay home in slightly smaller numbers than we did, because we're not putting up with this. So I think we have the electorate that we need, Catherine, to actually elect somebody who is not completely awful, or mostly awful. And that hopefully in 2020, maybe we'll, you know, we'll actually have an opportunity to vote for somebody who inspires us rather than repulses us.
She can't. She's stunned into silence. That's you would close on such an optimistic.
No, I don't know what happened to me. I forgot.
Jaunt.
Just thinking about TGI Fridays. That's the real silence here.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's better than Ruby Tuesday.
The endless breadsticks.
Yeah. I think does TGI Friday have the endless apps or is that Applebee's? I can't remember now.
I think it's TGIF.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And like you don't know.
No, I'm trying to think. I haven't been to TGIF in about probably a year. I went to Applebee's not too long ago. I go to
that
Chili's.
Started off as a week, and then you were like,
Yeah.
I have no shame for that. My dream is to go to all of the chain restaurants in Times Square in New York and see how they are compared to the units that are out in the real America to see if
they're bad
in Manhattan. Yeah.
They have New York values.
But Catherine, why don't you talk about something that is of ongoing concern and interest to our audience, which is vaping. And there are now, you know, the long fight against vaping because it looks like smoking. A couple of cities have passed anti-vaping laws. Where are they? And is this the beginning of the end of all of our freedoms?
Definitely not the beginning of the end. We might be like midway through the second half of the end. That could be about where we are. Austin and Laguna Beach last week decided to clamp down on vaping in public spaces, instituting fines in both cases. This is such a interesting development to me because it's exactly the sort of thing that you might have raised, that libertarians might have raised as a boogeyman a few years back. Oh, you know, sure, they're coming after cigarettes, but soon they'll be banning anything that's fun or looks anything like smoking. And people would say like, oh, calm down, you crazy libertarians. And now, as far as I can tell, the only justification is well, there are two possible ones. One, some sort of vague precautionary principle. Well, who really knows what water vapor can do to the general populace? And then two is just this sort of bizarre, well, we wouldn't want the children to see something that looks a little like smoking and think it's okay. So if that's, you know, that's the rationale that was given explicitly in Austin. And I'm not quite sure how to fight that because you can't actually fight that by saying, yeah, it looks like smoking, but nobody's confused, chill out. Like, that's not a compelling reason to people who want to go all the way down the road on these bans.
What's interesting to me is that it's, you know, Laguna Beach, which is an artist colony in Orange County. That was awesome. Laguna Beach is the most lefty enclave of all of Orange County. Beautiful, weird, wonderful city, home of the acid trade in the late 60s
and
70s.
That's right. The Brotherhood of Eternal Love was headquartered there, and Timothy Leary was arrested there on a pot charge that made federal law precedence.
So a historically interesting place, but it's the same thing that we've seen in California. This like you could make a map of cities that went first in, you know, maximally decriminalizing marijuana or, you know, allowing for local pot shops to open up, and ones who banned smoking on your own property. It's like Santa Monica. Every town with the name Santa in the front. It's like Santa Monica, Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara do things like this, and it's you can't. And it's happening right now in New York. Bill de Blasio had a statement 7-10 days ago, you know, equating like people vaping with like drug dealers or something crazy. In the same city where Eric Garner was choked to death for selling Lucy's, that you see no kind of connective tissue in people's minds. I see this with Bill Maher, whose show I went on the other day. And like, he's a guy who's talked so much about legalizing marijuana. And then, you know, he would basically jail people for selling, you know, foods with too much like processed sugar in it. People can't make that connection. And it's I think it's born out of this sense of that the corporations are trying to kill us, man. And just they can't leave us alone with, and us, not even us, it's actually usually poorer people and their disgusting choices of what to put in their bodies that we have to somehow get, you know, if we can stop just one kid from vaping, Nick, it's worth strangling to death as many, you know, black market nonsense people. So yeah, you guys are making me nihilist this morning. Going against my nature.
Before we wrap up, let me throw out something though. You know, Catherine, you raised the question, and I, and Matt filled in some of the examples of like, we lose these arguments. Because in any given situation, this stuff takes place in a city or a town or a polity where they can get the votes or motivate the votes or whatever to ban this or that. But isn't it time to just make a kind of full frontal argument about, you know, yeah, like, you know, vaping is not something like if a company is putting out a product that is genuinely dangerous to your health in a way that they know and they hide or they lie about, you know, after saying it's certified as not being terrible, you know, that's a problem. Or there's also, you know, limited liability against new types of products on the market as well. But isn't it time that we start, you know, I mean, you know, in every conversation, you know, on every beach and every pool hall, just be arguing that it's like, look, you know, we should have maximum freedom to harm, you know, to harm or to pleasure our bodies as long as we are not, you know, blowing water vapor that doesn't have any negative health effects on people. As long as we're not blowing it in your face, just get the fuck out of here.
I think this is one reason that I'm always wary to go in with the type of libertarians or small government conservatives who are really into federalism, right? Because this is a great example of local tyranny. These are places where the culture enables the state to grow for purposes that have nothing to do with, you know, force or fraud against other people and everything to do with some kind of bizarre moralistic sense of what is and isn't appropriate behavior. So yeah, I actually do think the place to go with this argument isn't, well, if Laguna Beach wants to ban smoking, including vaping, in public spaces, that's fine. That's their prerogative. No, it's bad at every level. It's bad to stop people from doing things that don't hurt other people at every level of government. And yeah, I think that is where the fight is, because saying let's devolve it locally means that we wind up with you know, bizarre situation where we have. You know, people getting fined $100 for, you know, sitting, walking down a public sidewalk and breathing out.
Matt, final thoughts for today?
Embrace the darkness.
It's getting close to that. My final thought for today is that we're going to see people starting to defect from Trumpism in the United States Senate, and that's it's going to be interesting politically to watch who's that going to be. I've made this comparison before, and it's weird. I acknowledge up front, but I was in Slovakia during its first year of independence in 1993, and it had sort of an authoritarianish populist who wanted to make Slovakia great again, named Vladimir Mečiar. And I watched bit by bit as his governing coalition peeled off. The first as foreign minister, and then elsewhere. That's going to start happening, and the dynamics of it are going to be interesting to watch. Who does it, when, and why? I would keep a special eye on Jeff Flake and Ben Sasse in the Senate and some other people, just as watching the drama unfold. Look at what those people do going forward.
Well, do you think that'll be a win for kind of libertarian sensibilities and or policies when the Trump coalition starts to fray? Or will the extra space be colonized by, Budinsky's in the Democratic Party?
I think that the best thing that it will do is it will restrain whatever Trump has in mind to go against the concept of lowering tariffs worldwide. I think there'll be more a pushback against that, and it will hopefully restrain some of the kind of corruption of process on the law enforcement side of the federal government. Beyond that, we got a long, long, long ways to go before Congress is even strong enough to do things like pass a fucking budget. So I don't have any faith that that's going to change anytime soon. But I think that hopefully we'll see a little bit of restraint on the areas in which the executive branch has an outsized amount of power.
Well, that's something to stay alive for. I appreciate that, Matt, especially on this dark, dark, nihilistic Monday. Catherine, what is motivating you these days in a final thoughts kind of way?
To stay alive on this dark and nihilistic Monday? I guess what's motivating me is that sometimes good things happen on the local level, too. And I've been watching the Sanctuary Cities stuff again in Austin, right? So just so that I can give a little bright side to my Austin bashing today, the images of people in churches and other public spaces and in the Texas legislature protesting bad law on immigration and Texas's choice to enforce that law, even in cities that would rather not. That's good news. And so when I say we shouldn't always look to localities to be good, sometimes they do good. And pats on the head for that, Austin.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. My guests have been Matt Welch, editor-at-large of Reason, and Catherine Mangu Ward, of the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. If you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode, and you'll also allow us to get the message out. Thanks again for listening.